Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Architecture had become the art of building on time and under budget. But what about the architect who wants to re-engineer the design process, challenge the typologies and conventions, not to make a statement, but to serve the needs of those who will be actually using that building? That's what Joshua Prince Ramos does. He's a world-leading architect, and he's the founder of Rex. He'll be speaking tonight at the McNay at 5:30. And also with us, he's here this afternoon, also with us is Antonio Petrov, assistant professor of architecture at the University of Texas, San Antonio. And our phone lines are open. We want to hear from you if you got questions or comments about architecture and redesigning, reinventing the city of San Antonio as we move forward with all these big adventures, big buildings coming on. 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email questions and comments to the source at tpr.org. And Joshua and Antonio, welcome back to The Source.
Thank you. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
So, when Joshua, this thing keeps coming back to me as I read about you. You're saying that architecture as a Trojan horse.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
It really means that. Now, I'll start back from the core of our philosophy that we believe that there has generated an unfortunate and unnecessary tension between form and function, and we talk about performance instead, and that we feel that buildings should do things, not just represent things. They should do both. And what we've discovered over time is that if we can figure out what are the inherent constraints the project has and take positions on those constraints with our clients, that we can then couple or put inside of it, like a Trojan horse, whatever the agenda that the owner has beyond those, and that they can then seamlessly get through the gates of Troy, you know, metaphorically, so that in the end, the imperatives of the project don't bastardize it, right? You don't have an ambition that this simply can't be met by the constraints of the project. Rather, the constraints help shape it and create something exciting, something new, something you wouldn't have otherwise contemplated otherwise.
And so who, the gates of Troy. So who are the gates of Troy? Is that like the funder, the person, your client?
It's a bit of a dangerous metaphor because, you know, we are not delivering Spartans who are there to rape and pillage. But, you know, the idea is that you create something that naturally wants or moves easily through, if you consider the gates of Troy as being the constraints, that it moves easily through them. And then you can, you know, you're unbridled to deliver whatever you and the client think is important in terms of the agenda of the project.
Yeah, but challenging assumptions, trying to do something new can be like warfare. You know, people like, you know, if you want to find out who your friends are, try to change things.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see that it's not that easy. And the way you approach the building of a building, let's talk about the library in your hometown of Seattle. Mm-hmm. You did research. You wanted mm-hmm. to see what actually, how is this building being used? And even the people who ran the library weren't even aware of how the building was being used.
One of the key transformative moments in that design process was when, you know, we kept saying that, look, you've already experienced an evolution. You have gone from being a place in which physical materials are stored into a place in which what you provide is curatorship. And they kept saying, you know, that's not really us. And then we actually presented their own program back to them. It was a program that they had developed over the course of about 10 years and showed them that, in fact, their storage, their kind of traditional book areas, were only about a third of their program, and two-thirds of the program had already evolved into these areas in which there was high contact between librarians and patrons.
Social-type
spaces. And so our argument to them was, look, we're not asking you to change. We're just, our job is to be a kind of a mirror, you know, and we're helping you to see how you have already evolved. And more importantly, that you, the librarians, are really the key element that makes libraries retain their vitality. That, you know, if I were to get into my car and drive downtown, fight traffic, find parking, why would I go to a place in which I could get material that I could simply get off my computer? And the reason is, if I go down there, I interact with people who have PhDs in chemistry and social theory, social philosophy, and so forth, and that curatorship is what libraries actually can provide.
So let me ask you, Antonio Petrov, about your assistant professor of architecture at the University of Texas here in San Antonio. And you look at the San Antonio landscape and the skyline, and you're probably thinking, man, there should be more cool stuff coming up here, right? And it's kind of blah. I mean, maybe I'm putting you on the spot by asking you that, but
I think it's a fair question. I think, like, wherever we go, we could kind of like start asking these questions. I think that's why we brought Joshua here. We are really excited to have someone here with this kind of perspective, not just of architecture itself, but also like how it's kind of like born and derived from what's there. I mean, like, he just explained this process, and I think like we are really, really excited to have someone like him here that's not just like a good architect, but also I keep saying this to him, like a good listener, and I really think that kind of makes a huge difference in the process of developing architecture.
So we're getting ready to go into an age in San Antonio where new modern looking buildings are going to be popping up in downtown, and people are already kind of grumbling, saying it doesn't really match the surroundings because we have sort of an aesthetic for downtown San Antonio. And so let me ask you about that, Joshua, about how do you innovate, do new things, challenging things, and still be aware of the surroundings?
I mean, I have an answer that may not be pleasing to those people, which is that I see contextualism not as looking like everything else, but working within what is there. And typically you have to judge whether a building is, quote, contextual once it's built. And that's dangerous, right? I mean, because otherwise you would like to have a litmus test to say, yes, this will be contextual before we do it. But the real evaluation is always post-occupancy. How does the new fabric of the city perform once it's there? You know, there is definitely an aesthetic style here which has its history and it has its importance. But the reality is that style is an evolution of necessary technologies. They made sense. I mean, ideas of portico or using certain materials here, either they were available or they retained cold, so during the day they actually were, you know, cool to be in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And so, a color palette seems to be locked in downtown.
And so to say that we are now going to strip all of that technological and historical meaning and make it just an aesthetic is also, I would say, a bit unfortunate, right? We can build new contemporary buildings that work within the existing fabric, but that are just as true to their age as the ones that we want to work with.
And Antonio, what's the future of San Antonio look like right now in this regard?
I think that's a very interesting question. I think what's intriguing about San Antonio is like we have on one hand this permanence, you know, like that is based on the history of the city, the history that's kind of manifested in these historic structures like the missions and other things we have downtown. And then we have an unknown future. We don't know how it's going to look like in 20 years with plus 1 million people moving to San Antonio. That's kind of like a big unknown factor. But looking at architecture, I strongly believe that, I mean, to me, it's still a manifestation of social, cultural, economical, ecological systems. And it will always be this kind of like, I wouldn't say conflict, but that the past, the present, and the future will always be important aspects of defining architecture for the future.
And how does beauty work into this? I mean, the Ronald O. Perlman Performing Arts Center at the World Trade Center, I mean, that's, from what I've seen of it, your design, it's beautiful. It's going to be an absolute drop-dead beautiful building that people will want to go look at. But it seems like in some of your previous buildings that you were not that concerned with trying to create a thing of beauty, but more of a thing of practicality.
Look, beauty is incredibly important to us. We like to say in the office, we're just not dumb enough to talk about it in public. And what I mean by that is pretty much anything that we would do, you're going to have some people for whom it's going to appeal and for some people for whom it is not going to appeal. And so to go to the table and simply make an aesthetic argument is rather dangerous, right? You say, okay, I like it, and your client says, I don't, and then the conversation is over. And so we focus much more on, you know, going back to that Trojan horse idea, trying to identify what are their constraints, what are their ambitions, their agenda. And I'm not sure I would say that we are not concerned with the aesthetics of those projects. Rather, I would say that if you truly take the constraints and the positions to heart and that you try to find really tailored solutions, not conventional solutions, you'll arrive at something that maybe you've never seen before. And that may make people uncomfortable, right? It's something new and something challenging to them. But it's not the same thing as to say that we don't care about its beauty. You know, through that entire process, we are constantly editing it based on what we find.
So you're saying
beautiful.
That you arrive at beauty as you go through the process, and you don't start out with a preconceived conception of what kind of beautiful building you're going to develop.
Absolutely not. Now, we certainly have predilections. I mean, any person does, and as the head of the office, I have certain predilections. We go to great lengths to be self-critical of those predilections, meaning, you know, when we're nervous and it's the beginning of a project and you're trying to figure out what is the right solution, you will naturally gravitate towards certain things. And we allow ourselves to do that just to get something on paper and start to move and start to ask the proper questions. And then we start to strip those things back out. Like it's almost like how an artist will gesso a canvas such that there's something against which they can work. We do that. But, you know, in our experience, the most successful projects were ones in which we then went back and stripped out any kind of a priori expectation of what it was going to look like.
What about this process not being used for architecture? I mean, shouldn't mm-hmm. we be doing this for, like, so many other aspects of our lives? You know, especially bureaucracies and things that we just are mired in, a government?
It's a great question. You know, over lunch I was asked a question. It was sort of the inverse, which is to say that I think to a lot of people's surprise, we have lots of non-architects on staff. We have people who just train to think. That's what we find important. So if, you know, I can hire someone who has a PhD in chemistry who can think, I'm much more interested in that person than someone who's trained as an architect who just makes pretty pictures. That kind of rhetorical thinking, I think, can apply to pretty much anything. And surprisingly enough, we're in the United States, if you don't know what you want to do, but you want to be educated, you tend to go into law. You look at Europe, actually, it's the inverse. Or it's, you know, the highest number of graduates are architects, precisely because they learn a certain way of attacking problems. That is not necessarily the case in the United States in our pedagogy. I think we tend to focus too much on beauty.
And what about the signature, the authorship of the architect? And how has that not served architecture well?
Well, you know, I talked about this false schism between form and function. I think, you know, it's certainly a credible way of working. Many people have done it very successfully. I think we're seeing it start to diminish because the constraints are increasing in terms of construction.
You know, people want to be like Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, a brand person, architect, and he can look at a building he designed and you can see him there.
And look, that's a I will never say that that is not an acceptable way to practice, but it is certainly a practice that does not take as its root the idea that architecture should do things other than just improve our aesthetic environment, right? That architecture really can have economic results. It can have social
political
results. It ought to. And that's what I meant about the fact that we have currently, you know, the pendulum swung away from functionalism in the 40s and 50s all the way to formalism, and now we're sort of swinging back. I hope the pendulum will stop in the middle. I fear that, you know, with sort of, quote, new sobriety, I guess we're now, you know, the crash is now 6, 7, 8 years behind us. But certainly at the beginning of the crash, everyone started talking about a new sobriety, and I thought, oh, no. We're just going to – the pendulum's going to go all the way back towards pure functionalism. We're going to start building really ugly buildings again. But I think we're at a moment now and with a new generation of architects that demand both of what they do.
What about this high modernist stuff?
Look, I have a soft spot for it in my heart. I don't think that all projects should be that, but I certainly live in what most people might consider a rather sterile environment in my own home.
Okay. And Antonio Petrov, how are we going to harness these ideas and channel them in San Antonio? I mean, the architecture and thinking about architecture, talking about architecture, it should be a community effort.
I think in a first step, and I hope we've accomplished this today, is like just to start a new dialogue about it. I think like it's to not look at it only as like architecture.
I mean, even especially like right now, because we're seeing all of these changes in San Antonio.
Yeah.
And if we don't have everyone sort of dislinging, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, to start off conversations like that, and it's like, you know, do like you're doing with Broadway and your vision, and just adding that to this the general, you know, coffee shop talk.
But I think it's, yes, definitely, but it's also time to do things. I think it's like, you know, we've looked at visions and we've talked about this, and I think it's great to have him here and talk more about stuff, but it's also important that we start rearticulating or looking at it not as a problem-solving tool, but also like to rearticulate important questions that we need to kind of like start addressing. And I think, I think we're ready. I think the school is ready to take risks for things that are happening in the city and move forward and do things.
And so, Joshua, what role does public expectation play in architecture?
I think it depends on what the project is.
Even in an entire city, like, you know, if we people realize that the public is not going to sit by and take, you know, Salisbury steak one more time, it's time to come up with some pizzazz.
I mean, ultimately, every city needs to take ownership of its built environment. That's its civic duty. And, you know, I'll just we were speaking before we went on air of when we were working on the Seattle Central Library. Libraries tend to be a kind of de facto homeless shelter, and we kept having people in the community saying, "So, what are you going to do about the homeless shelter? About the homeless situation in Seattle?" And at some point, you had to respond, "Well, it actually is your problem. What are you going to do about the homeless situation? This isn't an architectural problem. It is something that
we shouldn't build libraries because there are homeless people who may come by." Joshua Prince Remus is the founding principal architect for the firm Rex. He's going to be speaking at 5:30 this evening at the McNay Museum. You want to go check that out. This is The Source.